Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Record PLC interim results presentation. By way of introduction, this is James Wood Collins. I'm the Chief Executive of Record. For those who don't know me, to my right is our Chief Financial Officer, Steve Cullen.
Good morning.
We are very pleased to be presenting our interim results today. We are taking part in the conference call facility, and the recording will be available on our website. I say the presentation that we're discussing today, for those of you on the call, is also available from now on our website, so please feel free to access that. Since we are recording the call, if I could ask those present, please, to ensure their phones are on silent. When it comes to questions, if I could ask you, please, to also introduce yourself, your name and institution. I think, as we have done in the past, though, we will be happy to take questions throughout the presentation, so do feel free, please, to interrupt if there are things that aren't clear or you'll benefit from an explanation on. If we start then on page three, the headlines. As is usually the case, given our quarterly disclosure pattern of updates, then much of what is in here has either already been disclosed, which is the case of the assets under management and the inflows for the period, as well as performance fees, or is in line with expectations. But I will take the time just to, I think, draw out the key elements for everyone's benefit. So we're announcing assets under management up close to 5% in US dollar terms. As a reminder, we report assets under management in US dollars purely as a matter of sort of industry convention. Our revenue and our cost streams are certainly our cost streams are overwhelmingly denominated in sterling. Our revenue actually is very mixed, close to 80% or so is non-sterling, but we tend to report AUM by convention in US dollars. So in dollar terms, that's up about 5%. Actually, in sterling terms, given sterling's depreciation over the 6 months, up about 10% in the period to September 30th, although in the time since then, there's been some retrenchment of that as a partial sterling recovery, but that's all included in the statement. Contributing to that growth in assets under management is about $2 billion in inflows across the period, and those inflows really cover all of the product ranges, passive hedging, dynamic hedging, and currency for return, so it's very gratifying to see that. I think as a result of maintaining fee levels across our funds and strategies, the management fees have been broadly maintained, slightly down on the first half of last year, as we've had the full year effect of some mandate changes come through, but slightly up 2% or so on the second half of last year, so that management fee figure about £11.1 million. We did not earn any performance fees in this six-month period. As a quick reminder, we have the capacity, the scope to earn performance fees, in fact, across all of our products, whether that's passive hedging, dynamic hedging, or currency for return. Performance fees will be earned over different periods depending on client-specific mandates. In some cases, it might be quarterly. In some cases, it might be over a six-month period or even longer. And those periods don't necessarily align with our financial reporting periods. Hence, we have the opportunity, as it were, as we're doing here, of reporting broadly positive investment performance over the period. But that doesn't necessarily translate into performance fees during that period because, as I said, we've got different sort of period ends for that. So the absence of performance fees over the period is largely, if not entirely, what accounts for the decline in revenue and hence the decline in operating margin. I think we've done a good job on cost control over the period and kept costs flat. We do not think about performance fee income in terms of sort of budgeting and expenditure, because that clearly we have to be confident in the management fee base of the business to withstand that. So there is a decline in the operating margin, but again, that's driven by performance fees, which are known to be episodic. That flows through in a very straightforward fashion to earnings per share. What we have announced today is that we've maintained the interim dividend at 1.15 pence a share. Again, as a number you'll be familiar with, our dividend and capital management policy is such that at the end of the financial year, we will look at total earnings per share. We will look at any changes in capital requirements due to regulatory changes or an assessment of capital required and working capital. And then we've got a policy of, subject to confirmation at the time, of fully distributing the excess of earnings per share over ordinary dividends and changes in capital requirements as a special dividend. We've done that for the last 2 years. That is, as I said, something that we explore at the end of the financial period rather than halfway through, so no surprise not to see a special dividend today, but no change to that policy of assessing capital requirements. So I think overall, headline results very much in line with what we previously disclosed, in line with expectations, good cost control and dividend maintained. What I was going to do, turning to page 5 of the materials, I thought it's worth, in a sense, taking a step back and really reminding ourselves why we see Record PLC as a growth business, what the growth story is, what the equity story is, because I think sometimes, particularly these events, we can get rather close to the details. So it's worth taking a step back and seeing the wood as well as the individual trees, if you like. I think the starting point is to recognize that as a long-established business, as a firm, we've been successfully operating now for 36 years. Many of our products and strategies have their own lengthy track records. Within that, I think the credibility, the reputation amongst clients, amongst consultants, the range of products that we've built and the distribution platform, all of that gives us a very strong starting point from which to pursue growth. If we think about the fundamental attributes of the business and the market that we're in, what we are really expert at is building relationships with institutional investors, understanding the opportunities and challenges they face in currency markets, and then devising and implementing strategies to meet those objectives. That expertise really is relevant to pretty much every institutional investor globally. There may be a few investors who maintain a purely domestic portfolio, but otherwise it's really relevant to everyone. So that opportunity set is very wide. I think we should also recognize in the currency market, it's by far and away the largest, most liquid market, trades latest BIS figures north of $6 trillion a day on an average basis. What that means is certainly within developed markets and within the vast realm of emerging market currencies, there are no practical capacity or liquidity constraints. There are no limits on us putting risk appetite to work, if you like, on behalf of clients. Equally important for clients, there are no constraints on them getting their money out again, so we have none of the sort of gating type issues that can be a challenge for other alternative asset classes. So I think that liquidity and capacity depth is a big part of the growth potential. The way we've organized Record as a firm is we are functionally organized rather than product organized. So we have a single trading team, a single portfolio implementation team, a single client reporting team. That functional expertise gives us the ability to manage individual mandates tailored to clients' precise and unique specifications, so we can offer a high added value service while retaining significant benefits of scalability. I think you'll be familiar in investment management, products and services, particularly in funds, with the concept that you can, as the saying goes, with a fund, you can sort of stick a zero on the end and multiply the revenues at no greater expenses. It's not quite as scalable in running individual mandates, but that function, based expertise and organization gives us a great deal of capacity to put more volume through that infrastructure. And then we're very strong, a strong capital position. In terms of the growth strategy of the business, that's key because it gives clients comfort as to our ability to continue to meet their needs and objectives. If we're running a currency overlay mandate on the totality of a client's global equities portfolio, for example, they may have 3 or 6 different fund managers managing that global equities portfolio. We will be running a single overlay strategy. We will often, therefore, be the largest single investment manager for a client by exposures managed. The amount of trust they put in us is critical. There are lots of ways we earn and maintain that trust, and one demonstrable one is the strength of the balance sheet, because that gives clients a high degree of comfort that we can continue providing that service. It also gives, I think, shareholders a good degree of comfort that the dividend policy is very well supported. So I think there's some very fundamental principles on which the growth story of Record, if you like, is built. If we turn to page 6, we can pick up in terms of how we see the current environment. I know a lot of you, maybe all of you, will have heard me say this before, but I think it's important to remember that the larger part of our business today is managing currency risk for clients. So every market event, every economic and political event or circumstance that gives rise to currency market volatility serves to remind clients of the risks that currency can pose to their portfolio, and that tends to drive conversations and drive demand for what we do. And I think it's important that we remind people of that, because if ever you catch me in blaming political or market uncertainty for difficult trading conditions, please point the finger and say, well, that isn't what you've told us in the past. We need to be held accountable to that. So we're certainly seeing that. If we think of the range of conversations and the pipeline of new business opportunities we're seeing now, we continue to see a broad and diverse range of opportunities, different client types, different objectives, different geographies. I think as is common elsewhere in institutional asset management, that needs to be balanced against the continued expectation on clients' parts that fee rates will come down for established products. With existing clients, we always try to mitigate that by looking to enhance what we do effectively to provide more value-added services, to provide better investment outcomes, often for the same fee rate. I think for new clients, we have to find and develop relationships with those clients who will value the level of differentiation and the service and the expertise that we bring. We are not interested in growing volumes for the sake of it and in writing unprofitable business. I think that has no appeal to us as a management team or to our shareholders. So the growth rate of the business really represents that balance between the breadth of opportunities we see and our insistence, if you like, on the old-fashioned virtues of profitability. We do recognize that to maintain that position in the market, to maintain that premium position in terms of the service we offer, we need to continue to innovate, to enhance existing products and services, to develop new products and services. We will do that very much, I think, increasingly driven by client demand, but equally driven by opportunities that we see in the market. That requires us to continue to invest, not dramatically different from historically, but continue to make measured investments both in people who drive that thought process and in technology. We've long used and invested in technology to support the service that we run internally in terms of the processes that we use to manage the programs we run for clients. I think there's an increasing expectation that clients should also firsthand, if you like, see the benefits of investments in technology in terms of how they interact with us. So I think we can see it as an ongoing program, but a program at a measured pace. So it isn't something that should be seen as alarmist in any sense, but I think that need to continue to invest in technology is a really, again, a constant feature with investment management.
Quick question on that.
Yes, do you mind introducing yourself, Ben? Thank you.
When one thinks of returning surplus capital via dividends, the pressure on rates being able to be charged and the requirement for an investment in new services and differentiation, how as a firm do you think about where those three end up levelling out?
I think it's inevitably something of a balancing act. I think it also varies by different products and strategies. So one, the passive hedging part of our business, biggest single exposures that we manage, roughly half revenues, that is a business where there are a range of different models that clients can sign up to. So at one end of the service proposition, one can sign up to a kind of bare-bones, no-frill service. The client takes on and maintains a lot of responsibility for determining what to hedge, in some cases how to hedge it. They're really merely outsourcing the execution. That is a low and a decreasing revenue margin business. I think the position we've always taken at Record, you know, we've got 85 smart, capable, thoughtful people based in, you know, Windsor, New York, Zurich. If you wanted to build a straight-through execution platform for hedging like that, you would have a cloud-based infrastructure, you'd have very few, if any, people. It's not at all evident to us that chasing volume in a declining revenue margin where we compete with global multi-asset class asset managers, that does not feel like a way best to reward shareholders' invested capital. Instead, I think what we will do is continually look to identify and understand those clients who value having something done on a more bespoke basis, who appreciate outsourcing the operational risk management to us, who appreciate all the enhancements that we can bring, whether it's in a best execution, whether it's transaction cost analysis, whether it's attenuating very carefully the horizons at which we hedge so as to minimize costs and maximize benefits. And I think there is a kind of constant determination that we need to make as a management team as to where those opportunities are best met. But we've also got to recognize that we need to keep developing new products and services because it tends to be that those offer higher margins. So as we're not interested in pursuing scale for its own sake, I think the shape of the business has evolved quite a lot over the last decade, but what we've done consistently within that is build the client relationships to understand the opportunities where our skill can be rewarded and move within that. And some of the things that we're talking about in the period which I'll come on to, I think, are good examples of that. So that's a good introduction, really, to the developments in the period that we're talking about a little bit on page six. There are really sort of four points, in fact, I'll pick up here. We've continued to develop and enhance the products and services. In particular, we're talking today about a new return-seeking strategy, the dynamic macro strategy. This came about from a hire that we made in New York of a portfolio manager who'd been running this strategy for about 15 years. We see it as very complementary to our own long-established, now 7-year-established, multi-strategy product. The record multi-strategy product is underpinned by a belief in predominantly systematic processes, in risk premium, if you like, or inefficiencies in the academic jargon that can repeat in currency markets, things like interest rate differentials, which drives the forward rate bias, trend following or momentum driven strategies, reversion to fair value. Those are sort of patterns of behavior that underpin the record multi-strategy process. The dynamic macro currency strategy has a different investment approach, more discretionary in nature, more macro-oriented, and that manifests itself in a very complementary return stream. So we'll look at performance later, but that strategy has tended to outperform in risk-off periods, periods where certainly the risk premium strategies like forward rate bias in emerging markets may be more challenged. So we see both the investment philosophy and the results as being very complementary to what we've done. And I think that's just recognizing that there are lots of different ways to approach the rewarded risk opportunities in currencies, that different investors tend to have different preferences between predominantly systematic and more discretionary. And I think our role as a management team in running the business is to try and meet as wide a range of those preferences as we have confidence in. And John Floyd, who's a portfolio manager for the dynamic macro strategy, is someone that we've known for many years. I think his track record is long established, his thought process is clear, and we think that's a useful addition. So that's now being run out of our New York office. The second point we're talking about is growing demand, particularly client-driven demand, for us to manage derivative strategies and derivative overlay strategies that reference asset classes other than currency. So we've seen a growth in clients coming to us and saying, you've been running currency-based derivative strategies, whether hedging or return-seeking, in fact, for many years. The clients themselves, I think, are starting to think more about using derivative overlays, often tactically rather than strategically, but using in other asset classes. So it might be the case that the client or their investment advisor has a tactical view on a particular asset class. They might feel that equities are cheap or expensive. They might think there's a credit opportunity. They might think they want to go short credit. We're entirely agnostic as to what that view is. What we've been able to do is use our middle and back office system. We've got a third-party system called Calypso, which is originally developed for banks, in fact. We were one of the early buy-side clients, and that has enormous asset class and instrument capabilities. So we can very quickly configure new instruments in that system. And we are finding clients are coming to us because some of the franchise benefits I talked about, the reputation, the longevity, the regulatory status, the relationships we have with bank counterparties, both in terms of the human element of the relationship, but also the trading relationship, the systems and processes we have in place, that will allow us to manage other derivatives. We've long managed equity futures as an overlay for clients who want to keep a dedicated cash allocation. So we've now started expanding that in response to client demand to look at equity options, to look at total return swaps, to look at credit instruments using typically referencing baskets of credit default swaps. Again, we're not managing the underlying. We're not claiming that expertise, but clients are keen to have a manager who can apply all the virtues of best execution, undertake their own EMEA reporting if it's an EU client, the whole package of services that we offer, and apply that to other asset classes. So we're starting to see that grow. So some of those opportunities that the clients are looking to exploit may be more tactical. It may therefore less be recognized as management fees and more in the kind of investment services line. But that's something where we've been keen and remain keen to develop. We talked a little bit here about growing the distribution capability. We now have four people based in New York. So that's John Floyd, the portfolio manager, is a new hire. We've had two people move from Windsor to New York to take that skill and expertise with them. So again, we, as those of you who've followed us will know, we do not indulge in reckless expansion. But again, where we see an opportunity, where we think there's the opportunity to meet client demand, we're very keen to do so. And then the last point I'll note here, which is on page six, which isn't it's less in a sense of product development, but is an evolution in the period. We talked at our results, the full year results in June, about making a modest but over time meaningful amendment to our variable remuneration scheme. So our principal variable remuneration scheme that everybody in the firm participates in is what we call the group profit share scheme. We've always had the flexibility to determine the size of that pool anywhere between 25 and 35% of operating profits. Excuse me, but in prior periods, it has been rigidly set in the middle of that range at 30%. I think what we've come to recognize is the way that individual participation in that variable remuneration scheme was set did a very good job in recognizing collective achievement, and that's important because, again, all of our functional teams collaborate and work together to deliver these end-to-end mandates to clients. But it probably overemphasized collective achievement, and we didn't use it in a sort of sharp enough fashion, if you like, to recognize individual contributions. So we've made some amendments to how we determine individual participation in that pool. We'll still remain within the 25 to 35% range. When we've undertaken that through line management and up to the executive committee, we've undertaken that individual assessment. The total size of the pool for this period has come out at 31% of operating profits, so hardly a radical departure from 30. But again, I think giving the ability at the individual level to better recognize individual contribution, not at the expense of collective achievement, but just shifting that mix, is something that, again, we would we would expect to drive further performance. Although the pool is slightly larger as a percentage of operating profits, because operating profits themselves are less in the period due to the absence of performance fees, then the pool size reflects that. So the total pool size is like 17% down. The both the positives and negatives of performance shared equally between employees and shareholders. There's a small increase in the size, which just reflects that individual approach.
Question on that. It's Andrew Mitchell, Edison. Just on that point, if you are fortunate and get a large performance fee, should we expect that percentage to just mechanically go up because a good result was had and people could feel that they were part of that?
Certainly not mechanically. I think the way that would happen is we would make a judgment for the investment teams involved. Their job is to deliver investment performance for our clients. So I think if we felt that individuals or an individual on that team had materially outperformed our expectations, then we've got the capacity to do that. But there's certainly no mechanical linkage. It's commonplace elsewhere in investment management, almost a sort of share performance fees between investment teams and the management company. We don't do that. Performance fees are treated in the same way as any other revenue stream. So that's we've talked about the growth story, we've talked about the current environment. There's a sort of quick recap on page seven of sort of the range of products and services that we offer. And as a quick reminder, we do tend to see the two distinct sets of opportunities. There is managing currency risk that clients acquire from their investment activities in other asset classes, which broadly creates the set of products and services on the left-hand side of the page, and then they're seeking rewarded risk opportunities in currency markets on the right-hand side. I won't necessarily talk through each of these in turn, but just to draw out a few highlights and sort of what's new and developing on that. On the left-hand side, you can see dynamic hedging, passive hedging, both as the long-established products. We've been talking about enhanced passive hedging now for, well, really probably in the PLC form for 3 or 4 years, and some of those enhancements date back now 5 years for the clients. We'll come on to review performance in that. We've got a couple of other return-seeking strategies that in many senses have been developed in particular as part of our relationship with WisdomTree, the New York-based ETF provider. So we don't undertake hedging for them as a mandate, but we do provide signals that go into the hedge constituents within some of their currency hedge ETFs. We've done that in developed markets since 2016. Last year, in collaboration with WisdomTree, we launched an emerging market currency hedging strategy. That's an interesting new development because historically, the view has been not to hedge currency risk in emerging markets. Nonetheless, we do get a lot of inquiries from clients about whether there is a way to do it that is less costly than simply maintaining that hedge. A momentum-based signal that effectively turns the hedges on and off, intended to catch an emerging market currency drawdown early and protect the client from most of that drawdown. That's proved its worth, and that's something, as I said today, that we implement as a signal service, if you like, for WisdomTree, but we can roll that out for other clients and certainly having lots of conversations. On the right-hand side, the currency multi-strategy is long established. We did add the range trading strand to that last year. We've also, and again, we've mentioned this before, we have been thinking very hard about the concept of ESG, of environmentally, socially, governance-driven investing, whether it's applicable to currencies. Historically, we struggled to make that argument, but over the last few years, we've successfully developed to our own and, more importantly, client satisfaction, a narrative as to how one can build a link between productivity enhancement as a driver of currency returns and then sustainable development, linking to the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and that gives us another dimension really with which to engage with clients on that topic. And then finally, with the dynamic macro strategy run out of New York that I've mentioned on the right-hand side there. So quite a diverse product set within that. If we quickly turn to investment performance on page 9, the data on page 9 is reporting investment performance for enhanced passive hedging. We briefly commented here, this is where we will seek to deliver investment outperformance over a passive hedge benchmark with a sort of fixed rolling and maturity structure. And there are different ways we seek to achieve that. Part of it is around costs and volume. Part of it is around looking carefully at the interest rate differential over different time horizons and optimizing the client's return that way. It is a more episodic return streaming. See, as with a lot of things that we do, including fee rates, this is talking about very small numbers, typically basis points rather than percentage points, but talking about small numbers on very large bases. This is the long-term return we've earned for this as a longer-standing representative account is something like 12 basis points a year in terms of added value. For those who are familiar with our revenues, the fees rather that we charge clients for passive hedging, typically single-digit basis points, being able to demonstrate added value that is multiples of the fee is a useful thing to do. Over the 6 months to 30 September, it was 4 basis points. So as ever, there's ups and downs in performance, but it continues to be positive. So I think we continue to see that as a valuable service to offer clients. If you turn to page 10, we have the track record for dynamic hedging. Again, it's always worth remembering that investment performance for a hedging mandate is, in some cases, it seems a slightly eccentric thing to look at, but it always requires one almost sort of stand on one's head because you expect to be making money in the hedge when you're losing money in the underlying and vice versa. To quickly remind you of what the various lines on page 10 represent, the green line, the currency return line, in a sense that's not what we're responsible for. That is the impact that exchange rate fluctuations, in this case against the US dollar, have on the value of the client's non-dollar assets. So when that line is going up, broadly the dollar is weak, so they're getting a positive return from holding non-dollar assets. When the line goes down, the dollar is strong. The blue line is then the hedging return that we generate through the dynamic hedging program that varies the amount that we hedge. The black line is what we term the protected currency return. It's really the sum of the other two. So the black line is the total currency impact experienced by the client. I think the two features I would highlight on page 10 is that this is now a long-term 10-year track record. If you look at the pattern of the blue line, the hedging return, you can see it demonstrates the sort of sawtooth or ratchet-type return that we would expect, so generating positive added value, in this case within the first 12 to 18 months of the mandate on the left-hand side of the chart, quite a long period of not adding value through the hedge, and really that was a period of somewhat strengthening dollar environment, but not really to the degree that the hedge could enormously pick up on. Significant added value generated around the 2014-15 period as we had a strong dollar, some sideways movements after then. And if you look over the last 12 to 18 months, at the right-hand side of the chart, you can see that blue line moving upwards again. So as it is, this is not the same return-seeking pattern that you'd expect to see in an outright alpha return program. We'll come on to look at those shortly, but it's exactly the pattern that we would look to see in dynamic hedging. If we start to think about some of the return-seeking programs, as you know, we tend to look at two of the various strategies we run in multi-strategy on a standalone basis. FRB stands for forward rate bias. The on page 11, this is the most, in a sense, most straightforward passive index tracking, really, exposition of the forward rate bias of the carry trade. The sort of yellow-colored line here is the FTSE currency forward rate bias index. That was an index, in fact, we helped FTSE develop now almost 10 years ago. The black line is the return of the Irish domiciled fund that we run following that. The fund tracks the index on a geared basis. It gives 1.8 times the exposure, hence the gearing. So I think this is a period where bouts of risk aversion in 2012, 2014 have caused drawdowns in that strategy, but I think if you isolate any risk premium on its own, those drawdowns are not unexpected. We can see a similar pattern if we turn to page 12, not identical, fortunately, but a similar pattern if we look at the emerging market strategy on its own. So this is a strategy of being long emerging market currencies funded by a basket of developed market currencies. As with all investment returns, you get a degree of volatility, but the upwards return drift there is quite evident, as is some of the patterns like the summer of 2018 drawdown. I think where we'd really spend most of our time talking to clients, now particularly clients who would come and say, what are your best ideas for a disciplined, predominantly systematic approach to return-seeking currency, that's when we look at the multi-strategy track record on page 13. So this is the track record for now the seven-year established flagship return-seeking product that allocates not only to forward rate bias in emerging markets, but also to momentum, to value, i.e. the concept of reversion to fair value, and since last year to range trading. I think what I'd really highlight and draw everyone's attention to is there's one statistic that we can give for each of these strategies, what we term in each of these tables, the information ratio. This is equivalent to a Sharpe ratio for those who are familiar with that in sort of invested investment activities, because we are running portfolios of derivatives without an underlay, without an investor strategy. It's termed an information ratio rather than a Sharpe ratio, but it again recognizes the relationship between return and risk, the higher the better. What I'd highlight, if you look at forward rate bias on its own on page 11, 0.28 over the period, close to 0.3. If you look at emerging markets on its own, it's 0.35, not exactly the same period, but these are long enough for that to be meaningful. If we look at the information ratio for multi-strategy of the period, 0.55, so material enhancement on either strategy on its own, and that, of course, that enhancement is driven by the diversification properties of having five different strategies in that program. There's no formal benchmark for multi-strategy, but on the chart on the table on page 13, we include something called DBCR Plus. That's the Deutsche Bank Currency Return Plus Index, which is broadly looking at the same opportunity set and the same strategies. I think we've handily outperformed that both on a improved return at reduced risk and hence an improved information ratio. So I think that strategy is continuing to show its worth. And then revealed for the first time on page 14 is the dynamic macro currency return. So this is the return for which the portfolio manager, John Floyd, as I mentioned earlier. I think if we look here, the information ratio of 0.47, that's, you know, very much comparable to that of multi-strategy. So if we were showing an information ratio of 1.2 here, I think, frankly, that would be implausible. If it was an information ratio of 0.2, it would be unsellable. But an information ratio of 0.47, I think, is credible and attractive. What is even more attractive, and you sort of, if you kind of flick between pages 13 and 14, you can see some of it, although we can demonstrate it more clearly showing them side by side. The times when the dynamic macro strategy has outperformed the value generation that you can see in 2008-2009, as a lot of you will know, there was quite a lot going on in financial markets in 2008-2009. It feels like it's very much lived experience for many of us, maybe slipping the history books for some, but the dramatic outperformance of the strategy in that period clearly provides a very powerful counterweight to any sort of risk-on strategy that will be underperforming in that period. We can see similar strong performance in 2014-15, and I think one of the good things about this strategy is I think it's commonplace in these sort of risk-off strategies to pay a heavy price in more benign environments, but I think certainly if you look over the last sort of 4 or 5 years of John's strategy, there's been some broadly sideways movement, but there isn't a huge price paid for the benefits of the protection in more sort of crisis-like periods. So we see that as attractive in its own right, and it's particularly attractive actually if combined with multi-strategy, and so excitement about adding that to the stable strategies. So that's hopefully more than an overview, but a useful update on the business, the strategy, and on performance. So at this stage, I'll turn to Steve to take us through some of the numbers.
Thank you, James. I will just, I think, just turn a few pages on the presentation just to sort of drill down a little bit into some of the headline numbers, which James has already covered at sort of the higher level. So looking at page 17, just in terms of sort of the movements on AUME for the year, we've had sort of positive inflows across both dynamic hedging and passive hedging and currency for return for the year. So total inflows of $2 billion, which has pleasingly been spread across most of or all of our product range, with the exception of multi-product. Turning over to page 18 and looking at the individual sort of splits, if you like, of the assets under management, the product mix has remained broadly sort of stable period on period. We can see an uptick across each of passive hedging, which saw inflows of $1.6 billion in the period, dynamic hedging with inflows of $0.2 billion in the period, and a currency for return, which also had net inflows of $0.2 billion in the period. What does that mean in terms of sort of effect on management fees on page 19? Half one 19, as James has already sort of alluded to, we were down 11.4 million a year ago versus 11.1 million this year, broadly as a result of we saw outflows in the sort of final half of last year, which have now obviously fed through into the first half year results. Pleasingly, we've seen an uptick in the management fees for the first half of this year versus the second half of last year. And that's a bit of a mix between, obviously, a bit of impact from the inflows that we've seen in the first half, and also there's been a bit of a tailwind from the FX that we saw in the first half of the year as well. But there's more to come in terms of the Q1 and Q2 inflows, which haven't flowed through to the infall to the management fees at the end of September. In terms of costs on page 21, and not a lot to add to what James has already said in terms of costs, we are very much focused on sort of the cost discipline side of the business, while we sort of focus as well on trying to grow the revenues. So in terms of personnel, I think recent years we have seen an increase in year-on-year headcount, primarily to sort of bring in sort of the additional capability to help us on our enhanced passive hedging product, as well as other products. The sort of rate of increase on headcount has slowed now, and that's a conscious decision in terms of bringing the right people in, but also a mix of investing in some of our IT-related infrastructure as well, as I think James alluded to earlier. So in terms of personnel and non-personnel, there's not really a lot more to say on that sort of period on period, half 2019 versus half 120, broadly flat. The reduction of the group profit share from 1.7 to 1.2 in the first half is 1.7 to 1.4 rather, is obviously directly linked to the fall in profitability, which itself is linked to the lack of the performance, to having no performance fees in the first half. On a cost sort of basis, I think period on period we've managed to maintain sort of the levels of cost across the business. On page 23, that just shows how the management fees and the costs flow through to the sort of income statement. excuse me. So operating profit margin, we've talked about management fees, we've talked about costs, so operating profit margin, as we've already said, has decreased in the half year, and it is broadly linked to the lack of performance fees. This time last year, we reported £1 million worth of performance fees. And the operating profit this time round reflects the no performance fees in the period. What does that mean in terms of earnings on page 24? I think generally just as expected, it obviously flows through to the basic decrease in the sort of EPS of about 20% from 1.64 in the second half of last year to 1.29 in the first half of this year. The interim dividend that's been announced is the same as it was for the first and second half of last year on the ordinary dividend, fairly comfortably covered, I think, by the sort of earnings despite the lack of performance fees in the first half. So, you know, 1.1 times covered. And then this time, 6 months forward, we will be looking at where the business lies in terms of total earnings per share and how that sort of plays out in terms of any potential special dividends over the ordinary dividend. I don't think there shouldn't be any surprises in terms of sort of the interim ordinary dividend that's been declared. On page 25, I do usually just sort of stress in terms of the balance sheet, that under sort of IFRS, we are required to consolidate the Irish Dublin funds that James has spoken about previously. So included within the sort of money market instruments greater than 3 months figure of 13.9, and the cash and cash equivalents figure of 9.6, which add up to 23.5, there's own cash, as we term it, of about 17.7 million in there, and the rest is the cash that we've had to consolidate from the seed funds. I think that's quite an important point, that people understand that, you know, included in there is some sort of external cash that we have to bring in and consolidate on behalf of the seed funds. I think the only other change from previous sort of balance sheets that we've discussed are the right of use assets that's been brought onto the balance sheet, which is all down to IFRS 16. I think every business is now having to capitalise their lease payments, so we've got a right of use asset of 1.4, which is offset further down by non-current liability of 1.5 of lease assets, but otherwise no significant change, I think, in terms of what we're reporting on our balance sheet. I think that was the detail that I was going to run through. I think most of that is hopefully self-explanatory, but if there are any questions, obviously happy to take them.
I ask about the sort of fee and competitive position.
Yeah.
Because I think you mentioned the enhanced passive is continuing to get more clients using that, and yet the fee rate that we see from the published numbers doesn't look to have varied that much. I was wondering how much further you think there is to go in terms of people adopting that structure, and whether you think that's going to affect the fee margin. And the other one is the broader thing that you've very consistently said, that you've got this constant escalator you've got to counter, you've got to run to stay in the same place in terms of fee margin. I was just wondering whether that's less of a challenge nowadays in that the competitors, they can't go below zero.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how that sort of dynamic is.
Yeah, no, both good questions. So if we think about the first one, I think in terms of existing clients switching from what you might call the core passive hedging service to enhanced, I think that has largely worked its way through. I think where we talk about increasing adoption of enhanced passive hedging, that is more with relation to new clients. So it's proving its worth in helping grow the business. When we first disclosed the impact of some of those movements to enhanced passive hedging, and particularly the trade-offs between management fees and performance fees 2.5 years ago, I think there was a recognition that enhanced passive hedging has the scope to earn performance fees. But of course, as with all of our services, we're equally happy if clients want to pay a higher management fee or the same or perhaps a lower management fee and a performance fee. So we can continue to win clients and enhance passive hedging without necessarily putting pressure on the management fee rate. In fact, it can actually further support the management fee rate. In terms of how much more is there to go, I think logically you're right, it would be odd for anyone to offer a kind of commodity passive hedging service for less than zero. but we thought it'd be odd for interest rates to go below zero, and that's happened. I think we have to recognise that we do at that less differentiated, undifferentiated service end, which is not where we want to compete. But at that end of the market, there are providers who may see passive hedging as a loss leader at the service, as something they do to build the broader relationship. So we are not interested in competing on non-profitable business. So I think it would be kind of premature to say that that pressure is over. Logically, we would like to say that people shouldn't write uneconomic business, but it may be that for other providers taking the round as part of a relationship, they don't see it in the same way. I think the challenge for us, as I said, is to ask ourselves, can we keep identifying, building relationships, and serving those clients who value it being done properly? And if we do feel that market is shrinking or being constrained, then I think, as we have consistently done over the past, we need to explore new areas. So hence, the growth in return-seeking strategies, the diversification of the dynamic macro strategy, the exploration and growth into non-currency derivatives. I think passive hedging clearly is a fundamental, significant part of our business now, but I think it would be kind of unwise for us as a management team just to assume that can remain the same for many years.
Ray Mayle, Pamir Gordon. Mr. Floyd and the business that he's got, I mean, obviously he's got a very long track record, as you've said. How big a business was he running, either in terms of assets or revenues or anything?
It sort of varied. When we took on the mandate, there was effectively just a modest amount of seed capital running with it. He had been running it on an investment bank managed account platform. That platform was due to be closed down anyway, so no assets came over with that. So that's really an individual with a track record that we have the right to use, but no consideration paid, no kind of assets seemed. I mean, in the past, he's managed certainly hundreds of millions. His strategy is very scalable, and it fits, in some ways, it fits the niche that is better known, really, than, we're very used to extolling the virtues of predominantly systematic processes, underpinning those processes, making some judgments within that. But clearly, there are a lot of people who've got a very successful approach that is more discretionary, and in so many ways, that's a more conventional sort of slot to sell into. I think what we found with John is a good combination of an individual who joined us on terms that work for all involved, but someone with a long track record and who we've known for a long time, and that's a good sort of combination of circumstances. I mean, as you all know, we haven't historically recruited external portfolio managers, but I think this is a good opportunity to try something new and complementary and different.
In respect to your comments about pipeline and client activity, it's always difficult because of the episodic nature of it, but what do you think the second half looks like? If you're going to be winning business, is it going to be from US-based clients? Is the Swiss market still... Where's the most interest at the moment?
I think it gives some flavour of the sort of types and quality and nature of conversations in different markets. I think starting closest to home in the UK, I think we've managed to get 45 minutes into a presentation without mentioning Brexit, but it's impossible not to recognise that and particularly the anticipated outlook that brings for currency markets and other asset markets, I think that continues to be the sort of dominant aspect in the mindset of UK pension funds and institutional investors. So I think on the sort of traditional long-established client base of the asset owners, I think we're certainly having a number of conversations in the UK, but there isn't really a material shift or one. Things are sort of somewhat on hold. Where we are seeing more engagement within the UK in terms of the locality of clients is actually with specialist investment managers, particularly those in private assets, where we might be running a hedging program within the fund that they run. There are various reasons why our expertise and specialism lends itself well to that asset class. So I think that's sort of the nature and flavor of those conversations. And within those private asset markets, particularly within private debt, there's still an enormous sort of flywheel of fundraising, of commitments, investors, and by running the hedging, we naturally piggyback, if you like, on that. So that's the sort of things we're talking about in the UK. Switzerland, it continues to be a market where our main engagement is on hedging. It is a rather attritional market because the good news is there's a very high propensity to hedge. What that means is most people are doing it already. So if we're winning business, we're going to be winning it from an incumbent. And therefore, if we're trying to win business as a high quality, high service offering, we've got to find that part of the client base that most values that. So I think we'll probably see that as I think there'll be some further developments there, but unlikely to be enormously transformative. I think in the US, we're certainly having some hedging conversations, but if anything, that's probably where we're seeing more interest in return-seeking currency. So I think it's quite Canada, we've got some opportunities elsewhere around the world sort of more episodically. So it is quite varied, and I think that's important. One of the things, consistently that we've worked on over the last decade or so is building that diversification into the business, whether it's by client type or location or investment objective. And we're seeing that reflected in the sorts of new business conversations we're having.
Jeremy Grime, Charlton Illingworth. Can you just elaborate a little on your distribution strategy? Perhaps in the light of, I'm used to seeing fund managers talking about their crack sales team.
Yeah.
We've got two new listed FX companies with highly incentivized sales wins. So perhaps you can put yours in the context of that.
Sure, I'll take the second part of that question about the comparison to some of the other listed FX markets. So that would be people like Alpha FX or Equals Group, for example. I think it's absolutely critical to say our business model is very, very different from theirs. So not for me to comment on other people's businesses, but I think those firms operate a model I think that is better described as a sort of broking rather than investment manager analogy. They will often be a principal with a match principal on those. They tend to target, in some cases, individuals, in some cases SMEs, small, medium-sized enterprises, where they'll be acting as the principal and the counterparty to the firm in undertaking hedging on an episodic nature. That is, as you say, a very marketing and sales-driven process. That's a particular business model. We act as an investment manager, which means we've got the discretion authority to transact for clients. Our clients tend to be asset owners, pension funds, endowments. We tend to do much greater volume, much more strategically. It's a longer-term relationship. It's a longer-term process of building that relationship. So I think the business models superficially seem very similar, but actually fundamentally it's as different as in other securities markets a broking model is from an investment management model. And everything that means for risks borne by shareholders in terms of balance sheet risks, all of those are very, very different. In terms of, take the first part of your question about our own distribution approach, we have a sales team now spread across three locations, so Windsor covering the UK and anywhere else in the world, Zurich, which covers Switzerland and increasingly Germany, and New York, both to the US itself and Canada, and any opportunities elsewhere in the Americas. A lot of institutional investment managers can be very consultant-driven in their client engagement and new business generation. Investment consultants are important to us, so we have individuals whose job is to focus on building those consultant relationships. But currency management is not at the center of typical investment consultants, not at the front of their mind in the way that global equities or core fixed income would be. So we wouldn't want to rely purely on that. Instead, the majority of the people in our sales team spend their time building direct client relationships. And we can do that very effectively from the UK. We do that through meeting clients directly, through presenting at conferences and industry events. We can do it very effectively in Switzerland in particular by having a market presence on the ground in Zurich. That's very much a word of mouth in some ways is the most powerful recruiting tool in Switzerland. It's clearly much more of a challenge in the States given the size of that market and the number of investors. The strategy, so there's a number of strategies we employ to overcome that. Consultants are part of it. speaking at industry events and at conferences and sort of broader-based marketing is part of it. But we've also tend to find that rather than trying to spread a necessarily small team too thinly over the totality, we tend to find that building relationships, working through connections, working through existing relationships, that sort of network and cluster effect is a good way to grow the business there.
So with your new products coming on stream, would we expect the growth to come from new clients or from new products to existing clients?
It can be both. We've had good interest and engagement from existing clients, both hedging and return-seeking clients, on some of the newer strategies like the dynamic macro strategy. And then there are clients to whom that is in more of a kind of an intuitive way that gives us the opportunity to open those. So I think we're open those relationships. So I think we're seeing both of those conversations. If there are no other questions in the room, do we have any questions on the phone? Do we think?
Thank you. So ladies and gentlemen, if you're on the phones and you have a question, please press 0 and then 1 on your phone keypad now. And then after I announce, you just ask that question. And if you find that question has been answered before it's your turn to speak, just press 0 and then 2 to cancel. And there'll be a brief pause while any questions are being registered. Okay, at this stage, there are no questions from the phones. Can I please pass it back to you for any closing comments at this stage?
Thank you. I'll quickly give those in the room the opportunity to ask any last thoughts or questions. Well, if not, thank you all for attending. As I said, the presentation materials on the website, the audio cast of this call is on the website, and as importantly, both Steve and I are always keen to make ourselves available for investors and for analysts, so do please feel free to contact us at any time with any further questions. Otherwise, thank you for your time.
Thank you.